Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast, exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings, interviews Dr. Lance Simpkins, a highlighted speaker from Obesity Medicine 2021 virtual conference, about the connections between obesity, inflammation, and cardiovascular disease. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leaders in obesity medicine.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education at the Obesity Medicine Association. And I have with me today Lance Simpkin, MD, who has served as Chief Wellness Officer at Tenet Health in Pompano Beach, Florida. Dr. Simpkin is board certified in internal medicine, cardiology, nuclear cardiology, interventional cardiology, lipidology, and obesity medicine. That's a lot of exams. Hi, Dr. Simpkin. You spoke at the OMA 2021 Spring Virtual Conference. Your presentation was titled A Hot Mess, Obesity, Inflammation, and CVD Systems Thinking. Thank you for being with us today, Lance.
Thank you, Dr. Pennings. It is an honor and a privilege to be here.
Certainly call me Nick. So we used to think of atherosclerosis as a progressive narrowing of the inner lumen of arteries, similar to a rusting of an inside of a pipe. But really, it's much more dynamic than that. You call it a hot mess. What makes it a hot mess, and how has thinking changed with respect to the evolution of cardiovascular disease?
So, you know, you're spot on the blockages within the pipe used to be the major focus, and as an interventional cardiologist, I had the opportunity to go in and scrub out some of that rust out of the pipes as a plumber. But as we've learned more, there's a lot more involved. But certainly the big thing is, as the number one killer that is still persisting, we've got a lot to do. And that in and of itself is kind of a hot mess. The thought of discussing a hot mess, though, more than just the problem of atherosclerosis and coronary cardiovascular disease really comes from systems thinking and looking at different variables and its contribution to the expression of disease and pathology. When we look at cardiovascular disease in association with other diseases, such as the disease of obesity and the process of inflammation systemically and locally, it creates a greater milieu of conditions that can lead to expression of disease. And I think it's really important to use that systems thinking to understand influences, that it's not just the fault of diet. It's not just the fault of genetics. It's many, many, many variables that interact. And, you know, we talked about in the talk that we have 48 organ systems that potentially interact with each other all of our lives, that creates 103,000 interlocking triangles. So it's incredibly complex, and we have to be careful not to oversimplify it.
Yeah, it is a very complex system. And you mentioned about the relationship between obesity and inflammation. How does obesity promote inflammation in the body, and how does that contribute to cardiovascular disease?
So, you know, traditionally, our thought was that all of this extra stress of this fatty tissue was causing stress on the heart, both by fat mass implications and systemically. We keep learning more and more. We've learned for some time now about the amount of chemokines, adverse cytokines, adipokines that cause adverse amounts of inflammation and other processes systemically that can lead in a systemic way to cardiovascular disease, inflammation, increasing risks of myocardial infarction and other events, arrhythmias. But it's more recently that we're understanding that there are several different types of effects, both locally and systemically.
So other pro-inflammatory conditions are associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease, like rheumatoid arthritis is another example where inflammation in the body leads to, inflammation in the intravascular system, endothelial disruption? Where is it affecting the circulatory system?
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, that's systems thinking. So in the past, if my patient happened to have rheumatoid arthritis and I sent them to the rheumatologist, we got to say hello by chance. You know, oh yeah, you're working on the same patient on a different problem. We see that differently now. And this research has led us to understand that these are interconnecting problems. And now we've learned that C-reactive protein is as powerful a risk factor as systolic blood pressure or non-HDL cholesterol. So the link between inflammation and cardiovascular risk is clear.
So one of the consequences of progressive visceral fat formation is the development of epicardial fat. The progression of atherosclerosis is often thought of as primarily an intraluminal issue and inside-to-in model, but you discuss an outside-to-in model where epicardial fat directly contributes to heart disease. So what role does epicardial fat play in both atherosclerosis and heart failure?
So, yeah, and again, thanks, Nick. It's a great question. It was probably the greatest learning opportunity for me during the preparation for this talk and taking a deeper dive into this inflammatory process. I used to see echocardiograms with fatty tissue around the heart in patients that suffered with obesity and, you know, really thought of it as just an extension of that extra deposition of fatty tissue everywhere in the body. I really didn't think much of it. I just thought it was kind of another sign that they need to lose some weight. Taking a deep dive, though, it is absolutely crystal clear now that this epicardial fat may actually be, and there's good data to support this now, more important in the impact of cardiovascular disease than the systemic effects of the generalized adiposopathy or the central adiposopathy that we focus on a lot. Statistically, it has a greater impact on rates of atrial fibrillation and cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease, than the BMI or the amount of waist circumference excess visceral and belly fat, if you will, that we traditionally think of as a major risk factor, which it still is. But statistically, studies showed that this epicardial fat, this epicardial adipose tissue, has a more powerful statistical impact locally. And the way that this has been worked out is that this extra collection of adipose tissue directly diffuses into the surrounding tissues, which is the paracrine route of basically diffusing into the surrounding tissues directly. And whether that is inflammatory chemokines, adipokines, cytokines, or actually activated macrophages where the M2 more stable phase goes to the more aggressive M1 phase of activated macrophage leading to the inflammation, which leads to fibrosis in the cardiac tissue directly. And then there's the vasopressin route where that epicardial adipose tissue also releases the same chemokines and cellular factors into the microvasculature around the coronary and myocardial structures.
And so we always used to think of fat as just sort of this inert substance that existed in the body and served a role to store calories and provide insulation. But this really is another extension of the understanding that fat is both a very active endocrine organ as well as a very pro-inflammatory organ.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Nick, in that, again, when I started reading about this, oh, epicardial adipose tissue is a bad thing. Well, that's actually not true, just as fatty tissue in the body is a bad thing. That's, of course, not true. It serves a very useful function. And in most humans, epicardial fat is a normal finding. It is there, and it serves useful function to distribute fatty acids and keep them out of the microvasculature and store them for future use when needed in the fatty tissue. We talked about during the talk about a concept of allostasis, where allostasis meaning creating change through stress, but for a positive reason. So we have these extra calories that we absorb. We have extra fatty acids. We store them in adipose tissue, and that is useful for a time. until the allostatic load becomes so great that it puts too much stress on the surrounding tissue, creating inflammation, creating hypoxia, creating fibrosis, then leading to systemic and local disease.
Right. So in some ways, kind of conceptually, adipose tissue can be a sponge to absorb those excess calories when needed. But when the sponge is saturated, then they spill out of the sponge and circulate in the body and cause their lipotoxic effects.
Yeah, the sponge doesn't work properly anymore. It starts leaking.
Yes. In 1933, William Tillett discovered streptokinase, but it wasn't until 1986 that a randomized multicenter trial showed that streptokinase was an effective therapeutic intervention for acute MI. Thrombosis is now well recognized as an important component of cardiovascular events. How does obesity contribute to the risk of developing thrombotic effects like acute MI or stroke?
Yeah, so again, it's interesting. And again, I think that the epicardial adipose tissue, probably even more important in these issues locally for the myocardium and the myocardial thrombosis and myocardial infarction. What we've learned is that there's an imbalance in adiposopathy in general, and perhaps even more powerful with the epicardial adipose tissue imbalance, where prothrombotic adipokines such as leptin, PI1, resistin, bisfatin start to overload the system and outweigh the protective or anti-thrombotic cytokines such as adiponectin and apelin. And this imbalance leads to more prothrombotic states locally and systemically.
So that's very interesting. There are a lot of other agents that play a role, pro-inflammatory, prothrombotic agents that contribute to cardiovascular risk. So do you see a role for monitoring things like leptin or adiponectin or other pro-inflammatory agents to assess cardiovascular risk in the future?
It's a really interesting question. Certainly came across some research that made me think about those things. Today, I still think that these are just markers as risk factors to make us more aggressive about prevention in general, which, of course, the foundation of therapy is risk factor modification. And then the lipids, using statins and other lipid-lowering agents to the best of our ability to protect people and get them to whatever we believe is their proper goal. C-reactive protein is certainly, as we talked about, a powerful, commonly used inflammatory marker that it signals increased risk and is another push with good data towards the use of statins for prevention of events. During the talk, we talked about canakinumab and getting back to your rheumatoid arthritis referral. And our friends, the rheumatologists, used this drug for inflammatory rheumatologic conditions. And it was studied in a post-MI population and was shown that by targeting the interleukins and C-reactive protein in those patients with elevated levels, they actually had lower rates of recurrent cardiac events, statistically significant. But then beyond that, as we talked about systems thinking, a second sub-study showed those same patients had reduced rates of lung cancer. So completely different pathophysiologies were affected by the same agent attacking interleukin and C-reactive protein and significantly lowering their levels. They did respond. So will it be a target of therapy? It's certainly possible. And my guess would be yes, but we're not quite there yet. It's more of a marker of inflammation to talk about risk and aggressiveness of therapy.
Right. And we see also the role of inflammation in COVID infections and in turn cardiovascular complications associated with COVID infections. And there too, do you see an inflammatory connection there?
Oh, goodness, yes. I think that if we've learned nothing else, that, one of the biggest risks, and I'm not a virologist or epidemiologist, but one of the risks is it's actually our own body's response to this virus that does so much of the damage, not the virus itself. It's obviously a horrible scourge, if you will, on humanity right now. But it's really allowed us the opportunity to understand how powerful that inflammatory reaction is, that autoimmune response.
Absolutely. So one of the dilemmas in the relationship between obesity and cardiovascular disease is something that has been dubbed the obesity paradox. Individuals with obesity, particularly class 1 obesity, have been reported to have better outcomes after cardiovascular events like MI and stroke. So on the one hand, having obesity increases your risk of cardiovascular events, and on the other hand, those with obesity seem to have better outcomes. How do you make sense out of that?
Yeah, I mean, and that we have to be careful saying better outcomes because it's certainly very specific diagnoses and subgroups that have that. I'm still very curious about this. It's certainly, I don't feel that my patients with obesity that I see for cardiology are protected and reassure them not to worry about it because they're in a better group. I think there's stuff we're missing, and I think it probably may wind up being a genetic component. And spill over into the genetics of inflammation and other inflammatory processes. I don't think we've had it quite teased out yet. It certainly doesn't make sense. It's never made sense to me. I've never been able to make sense of it clinically, and I think there's a lot more to learn. I think it's interesting breaking down subgroups based on inflammation levels, looking at those high and low risk populations. I think we're going to find differences ultimately to at least give some, you know, explanation as to how this happens more than why.
You mentioned some about the role of epicardial fat playing in disease. Could it have some protective benefits or healing benefits in patients that have had cardiovascular events?
You know, and again, individual variation, I don't understand yet. I don't know that we have that much clarity statistically. As populations, the epicardial adipose tissue is clearly a major risk for multiple cardiovascular events with particular attention to atrial fibrillation, just way more powerful in the rates of atrial fibrillation than belly fat or, you know, the extra visceral fat that we see with adiposopathy or generalized adiposopathy, much more powerful. But again, is it possible that some people have more adipose tissue with lower levels of inflammation? That certainly makes sense. We know there's variability. How much of that is genetics? How much is stress response? And we didn't get into it today, but a lot of my thinking about this hot mess was also thinking about the emotional part of a hot mess and talking about allostasis and stress. We talk about emotional issues. We talk about the mental health issues in this country and in the world. And I actually presented data during the talk showing the amount of information we have on inflammatory markers being raised in association with behavioral issues, be it anxiety or depression, and that whole spectrum. And we've forever believed that, oh, I had that heart attack because I was under so much stress from work or whatever. And I used to say, sure, we're all stressed. We all have stress. But looking at the data, it is real. There is, you know, correlations between mental health and inflammation. And I actually believe that the disease of obesity and mental health probably have a bigger impact in my cardiac population than any two other factors that I can think of off the bat.
And literally a broken heart condition as well.
Yes. Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy aside, it literally is. And I've seen those, and it's impressive.
Yes. So lastly, when discussing obesity with your patients, what's your favorite bit of advice?
My favorite bit of advice is to kind of get real, that this ain't easy and it's not your fault. That the biggest bit of advice is to become accepting of this as a disease, as not a cause and effect where it's somebody's fault, but a system of multiple situations and conditions that have allowed this to happen. Acceptance is important. Awareness, I believe, is even more important. And when we begin to be aware how powerful this beast in our brain can be and how instinctual and evolutionary it is, it's really useful to be aware of that automatic reactivity that your brain provides you every single day of your life, and to understand that that's the foundation of how we evolved as humans. And it was only way later in our evolution that we developed the capacity for higher thought and logic and reasoning to allow us more choices in how we manage that beast, if you will. And just being aware of that and actually being able to see one's own, not even hunger. Hunger is a big one. It's a big automatic process, but also other emotional reactivity, right? We feel bad when somebody says something. Why we feel happy? What gives us pleasure? Where does pleasure become a problem? All of these different variables, it is awareness, I think, is the number one key, and not beating yourself up for being human. I think allowing people that understanding that there's nothing wrong with them, but that they have a condition that we are working on to improve their overall health is really helpful. So it's both from the physician standpoint, accepting them where they are, and also giving understanding of how important it is for them to accept this for what it is and learn about it, be curious about it, and not beat themselves up over it.
Yeah, so we spend a ton of time on what you eat and lots of books about what you eat, but very little time on why you eat. And I think that is something that patients need to understand and we need to convey as healthcare professionals. Well, absolutely. Thank you for being with us today. You can find Dr. Simkin's talk titled A Hot Mess, Inflammation and CVD Systems Thinking in the Obesity Medicine Academy at obesitymedicine.org. How else can our listeners learn more about you, Lance?
Oh, goodness. Google me. No, email me, call me. I am happy to chat with anybody at any time. LASimkinsMD@gmail.com. Feel free to shoot me an email. I've had a number after the conference. Happy to chat with people. Definitely, this is an important problem, and I would love to see us make continued progress during my work on this planet.
And I appreciate you sharing your insights. Nice talking with you.
Great. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Drs. Pennings and Simkins. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Loved the episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show hosts and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back in soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.